So you're listening to our Health and Safety Forum, hashtag prepared. And let me reintroduce the panelists that are taking part in this. We have Sheriff Ozzy Knezovich, Spokane County. Jerry Bozarth, the Spokane County Emergency Management Assistant Director. Assistant Fire Chief Brian Schaefer. Susan Joburg from the Spokane Regional Health District. Megan Snow from the American Red Cross. Marcus Riccelli, representative of the Washington Legislature for the 3rd District. And I'd also like to thank our program sponsors. It includes the Elson S. Floyd College of Medicine from WSU, Providence Healthcare, the Journal of Business, Numerica Credit Union, and also Spokane City Cable 5. And thanks to our studio audience for showing up and all of our volunteers as well. So a little bit of background on the earthquake. We know that it's just a matter of, you know, not if but when there's another major earthquake out in western Washington, and it's been called the Cascadia earthquake. Doing a bit of research, the 1700 Cascadia earthquake occurred along the Cascadia subduction zone. They actually know the date, and they base the date on a massive tsunami that hit in Japan, and they have records of that. January 26, 1700 was the date. Estimated magnitude 8.7 to 9.2, which is extremely severe. It went from mid-Vancouver Island in BC down the Pacific North Coast, West Coast, as far as Northern California. So it is possible such a massive earthquake could happen again in our lifetime. The geological record reveals that the great earthquakes, those with a magnitude of 8 or higher, in the Cascadia subduction zone occur about every 500 years on average. Now, in addition to that massive earthquake, there's been research that indicates that there have been potential for smaller earthquakes right here in Spokane. We had this swarm of earthquakes that took place here in 2001. You may record them. There weren't any major damages, but it's something we're talking about. So I want to talk to Jerry Bozarth again, because there's apparently a major exercise that's scheduled for later this spring to deal with that, and we're involved. Our East Side Washington folks are involved in that as well, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's correct, Steve. Cascadia Rising is the exercise, and it's actually taking place in the first part of June. This has been in 2 years in the planning stage between FEMA and the state and many, many different organizations. Pretty much all the jurisdictions on the west side of the state have been involved at some level, and much of eastern Washington has been involved, including lots of jurisdictions here in Spokane County. A lot of what they're looking at is, you know, how can we respond to that? And it is a fairly overwhelming situation in most cases. So they're kind of taking bite-sized pieces to it and looking at different pieces. A big piece that we're going to be involved in is we figure that, you know, when that happens, there's going to be some So a lot of communication problems. There's going to be probably power problems. But the communication piece, we have an amateur radio group here in the Spokane area that is going to practice during that time, take a day, and practice sending messages back and forth, because ham radio and that kind of communication is going to be critical during that time. Mm-hmm. And I'll allow Susan to talk about the health implications during that. Susan?
Thank you. We're going to actually practice, do a full-scale exercise as public health in setting up an alternate care facility with one of our faith partners out in Spokane Valley, with the prompt being a mass evacuation from the west side of the state and lots of people coming into our community that need support with medical needs in conjunction with the American Red Cross shelter. The healthcare system has a plan in place called a disaster medical coordination center, and that role of those designated hospitals is to find placement for patients in facilities all across the state. So the state level plan, and so that is going to be exercised again, that communication role, knowing that there may be patients from the west side that need are still in care of a healthcare facility and need a stable environment to continue that care. So that will be that communication component will also be exercised this year. Adam, are you or Daryl aware of other healthcare associated exercise plans?
So from the east side of the state for Cascadia Rising, we will be doing some WATRAC alert and warning coordination. And so really it goes along with what you've been saying for the broader Cascadia Rising event. But some of the statistics I was just looking at to review myself, refresh my memory for the Cascadia Rising, I think are just staggering and worth mentioning. But we've got modeling data on it that is based on a 9.0, and it's in February on a Tuesday. And the reason that's important is because the biggest number of deaths and injuries is from the tsunami that follows an earthquake. And so if this event were to happen in the summer, the projections would obviously be much higher. But just to kind of put this in perspective, much of the infrastructure west of I-5 is going to be no longer functional. And so what they're predicting is around 8,000 to 9,000 deaths. Injuries, I think, is on the order of magnitude of around 12,000. There's around 15,000 patients that will need to be evacuated from hospitals that are no longer functioning, and they're estimating around 65,000 people from nursing homes. So it's really an event that's far surpasses anything that we've seen. And as was mentioned, I think by you, Steve, and Jerry, the scientists say that it's overdue. So it might not happen in our lifetime, but it might happen next week. And so, you know, circling back to one of the themes that I think is really important here is that preparedness component and the relationships that everyone has are vitally important for all of us to be able to work together and respond, whether the event is here, whether the event is on the west side of the state.
Marcus, has the state legislature, ever specifically looked at funding for preparedness in relation to this, or are these discussions happening? Or?
Yeah, so I would go back again to our military department, and when the adjutant general comes in and addresses us, the first thing he starts with is concerns around the earthquake and what we're doing to prepare that. So, specifically it's around funding of that, the Washington Military Department, their work around that. So,
I was thinking one other thing could be, long-term planning for what about a massive power outage that could last months? I don't know if this earthquake plays into that scenario and how it would affect, say, Grand Coulee Dam or the BPA infrastructure, but what about something like that? And this could go out to anybody in the group, just the whole idea of what if instead of having the power out for 2 weeks where we felt this was a massive problem to deal with, what if the power is out for 2 months? Thoughts? You guys must have talk about these kind of this kind of planning, or
it's not really something we want to think about, Steve.
I understand that. I just want to know.
Truthfully, it's anything's possible, but those are catastrophic scenarios. One thing that we can say for sure is that it's likely people from the west side, if they can make it to the east side, they will after this happens. And when I was the director.
You think they would mm-hmm. prefer to? Could they not stay out there if there was enough shelters for them? Or what do you think? You're saying that.
Well, there's going to be massive problems over there. There's going to be massive infrastructure problems. And many people's homes will probably be damaged to the point that it'll be risky for them to actually physically live in them. Okay. And so there was a statistic thrown around a long time ago when I was director of Medical Reserve Corps here in Spokane, that 1 in 3 people on the east side have someone, either a relative or know someone on the west side. I'm not sure exactly where that comes from, but it's likely. My sister lives there, my family's from there, and I don't know of very many people that don't know someone that lives in the Puget Sound area that live over here. And so if they can get over here, they're probably going to migrate here. And so we need to be prepared as a community to assist those people and the influx, because there will be an influx at some level.
Sheriff.
Steve, it's been really interesting to watch the dynamic on the planning for this event, because early on in the early phases, I brought up, what role for Spokane County? And it was kind of, go away. Not so much anymore. The role that we identified internally was we're a staging area. And then that moved from staging area to receiving area. And it this event is getting more and more traction as far as what does this really mean? And it means a major upset in the entire economy for the state of Washington. It's going to be a major event for all the people on the west side of this state. And your question revolved around what happens 2 months without power. I would remind people that there are times during snowstorms, ice storms, wind storms, that we've had members of our own public here in the area out of power for 2-3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, everybody talks about 72-hour kits. I no longer even speak in the realm of 72 hours. I talk about you need to be able to prepare to handle your family and your own needs for up to 2-3 weeks. That the 72 hour just needs to go away, because it's to the point now that you really need to be able to either shelter in place and be able to handle that. It means you're not going to be able to run out to the stores and get everything. And if you take a look at these major events, the snowstorms, within 5 days, milk and bread were very difficult to find on the some store shelves. So it really comes down to no more 72 hours. Be prepared for at least 2 weeks.
And that's exactly where I was going to go next, too, and we can maybe talk to Susan and Megan about that. Because one thought I had, I think I saw a thing that if there was an earthquake in California, which is probably as likely or even more likely, that because they're the major food distribution centers, there could be a delay in getting the supermarkets up here resupplied, where we would be impacted for maybe even a week or two. But if you imagine no food in the supermarket for a week or two, how prepared are we? Do you guys want to talk a little bit about just personal preparedness? And I know he referred to the 72-hour kits, but so what do people have to be prepared to have for a couple weeks, like the sheriff was talking about, or 2-3 weeks? What do we need to do? What do we need?
Yeah, personal preparedness is a key thing that we should all be thinking of. You know, if you look at disasters, it's a cycle. It's prepare, respond, recover. We have to start focusing on that preparedness element. So what that looks like is at home, and sometimes it can feel overwhelming to people, but you start taking simple steps. You work with your family. You find a checklist of how much water per person per day for everybody in your family, including your pets. Never forget your pets. You're looking at a gallon per person per day, including your pets. Non-perishable food, a way to open non-perishable food, like a can opener, something to eat it with, is always important. You know, you can start taking those simple steps. Know where you're going to keep your kit. What else has to go in there? Flashlight, batteries, a car charger. I will personally share that right after the windstorm, I was searching in the dark for my car charger for my cell phone to be able to operate. I'm sure I'm not the only one in this room. Just, you know, there are so many checklists available through Red Cross, through prepare.gov, through FEMA, that you start just looking at those. Take an afternoon with your family, knowing that we just went through daylight savings. We always kind of focus on, you know, test your smoke alarms when you turn back your clocks. Same kind of thing with your disaster preparedness. It doesn't have to be this overwhelming type of a situation. It should be something you get your whole family involved in. Think about the unique needs in your family. I have an infant at home. Do I have enough formula? Right now I could say that's not the case in my house, and I need to start getting those things together. Think about your medications. You know, what are those key things that you need? Talk through a plan. One of the hardest things that we find with disasters is the emotional and mental impact it has on people. Having the time, taking the time to talk through, who are you going to call? Who outside of your family unit? If a disaster hits when I'm at work and my son is at school and my husband is somewhere else, do we know whom we're contacting if we can't get a hold of each other? Do we have an outside contact point? Having those plans in place will give you a better sense of security that you can handle things. The hardest thing when a disaster hits is your emotional state, when you're worried about your loved ones. If you can get that portion taken care of and you know you have a plan in place and you have your kit ready, you're gonna have a higher sense of resiliency. You'll be able to weather the storm a little bit easier. And again, I agree with the sheriff that your kit should be extensive. You know, let's over plan. Why not? There's no harm in that. If you're already going ahead, let's remove the 72 hours. Let's look at a week. But again, those checklists, that information is readily available. And just take an afternoon. Spend that time. It really will pay off.
You know, a lot of people have the kind of materials like camping gear.
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm just going from personal experience. You know, maybe camping stove and the like. But what about the people that don't? I mean, we want to, and you can get very specific here about what kind of things do people need in terms of if they had to prepare foods for a couple weeks, do they need to go out and buy camping gear or?
You don't need to, you know, if that's your preference. Again, you can make it through with non-perishable foods. You can eat a lot of tuna fish. You can have some, you know, high protein types of foods. That really is kind of the goal. You know, if you had to evacuate and you wanted to take that with you, what are you going to focus on? Can you grab and go with a go bag? And, mm-hmm. You know, you've got to kind of think through the different scenarios. You may not be able to shelter in place in your actual home if you're possibly in a wildfire zone or somewhere that needs to evacuate, but you also want to take some of those items with you. Is that the type of stuff that you have on hand? So you can kind of think through what makes sense for your family, what you have the resources to do and to manage. If you have no peanut allergies, peanut butter is a great option. High protein, easy to digest, easy to eat. You know, just kind of think through those options.
And I was thinking too, and this is probably, you probably covered this, but for food preservation, you know, in the winter when we had the ice storm, it was easy to take stuff outside and sit it on your porch, yeah. Mm-hmm. As long as your dogs didn't get into it or something. But so what about storage in the summer if we may not have ice available? And we were talking long term. Any suggestions of what type of foods folks should have? Or
it's the same type of foods that Megan just spoke of. It's canned, non-perishable, dried foods that you can prepare fresh outside on your grill or, you know, camping stove, or if you, those things that you do have, but anything that requires refrigeration or freezing, and there's no option to do that, needs to be thrown away, and you stick with the things that you know are safe.
And she mentioned medications. Now, that's something you probably would think of, but is there any, do folks have medications that they can't really get more than a month's supply at a time? Is that an issue with some folks? And then what would they do if it looks like you may, I mean, because you never know when these things are going to come up. So is it something you should talk over with your doctor about? Maybe I'm going to need something. What if something happens? Is that an easy thing to do with your doctor?
We failed to pass the 12-month birth control bill. There were people could get a 12-month. I'm just throwing a joke out.
Yeah, okay. Medications is a problem. It's one of the issues in a just-in-time society, really, where if you only have 30 days and you go to your pharmacist and you're at day 20, they won't fill it for you for at least 7 more days. And so that is an issue that we're working on across certainly the public health system with insurers around that issue. It's very complicated. I think the best thing at a minimum all of us should do that have medications is keeping that list, a list of those medications current and on your person. Because there are provisions to provide emergency supplies from any pharmacy for a short period of time until your physician can reissue that prescription or whatever because it's expired or you're done with it or you're in a new community where you need it filled.
Okay. This is a question for the sheriff, and it's kind of something we may get into a touchy area here, but there's obviously criminal elements out there, and if the power was out for a great deal of time, and I know you said there was no statistics indicate there was a lot of increase during the last event, but what about if people were going to steal, you know, your food, generators, property? I mean, what kind of advice do you want to give them? I know you have, like you talked about, the scope folks out, you know, watching to help the sheriff's department, but can you identify this? What are our rights if we have to defend ourselves and property from looters or desperate criminals? Because this is a question that would probably be in the back of a lot of people's minds.
It is. It's a question I get asked all the time. You have to understand that protection of property and using lethal force for that, the law really doesn't cover you doing that.
Mm-hmm.
The law is very specific. If you can use deadly force on an individual, if you believe that yourself or another is in imminent threat of serious bodily injury or death, it doesn't say that you can use it to protect property. Now, it doesn't, you know, your home is a different animal. If somebody comes in your home, you're there, and you feel that your life or the lives of your loved ones are in jeopardy, that's where the law kicks in.
Okay, so if it was a case where somebody was actually coming in your house to maybe steal your food or whatever, because I'm curious too, you know, if the infrastructure is down and folks maybe can't call the sheriff's department or something, they're kind of in a position where they're just going to have to defend themselves, correct? Or
if things get to that point, that's what you call the self-defense statutes would kick in, and there are times that that could happen. We're more and more reliant on cell phones. We just mentioned batteries and car chargers and everything else. A lot of people don't have landlines anymore. So if you are out of power and your cell phones go dead, there is no way to contact us unless your neighbor has a landline or their cell phone is up. So it really comes down to having a plan for your neighborhood. In suburban, urban areas, it's a little bit easier. The more rural areas, it gets a little bit more complicated, but you can still develop those strategies with your neighbors.
Okay. Now, I've got quite a few questions here from the audience. This is a question asking if there are comprehensive resource sites online to bookmark, and I know that we have some flyers that we've distributed for the event with a few references to books, but do you guys have any websites you might recommend or resource sites?
Many resources on the Spokane Emergency Management website. But Megan mentioned ready.gov. The Red Cross website is wonderful. It's on and on. I mean, you can find health-related items on the Spokane Regional Health Department's website. There's a lot of resources out there. And if you just have a specific item that you're looking for, you can Google that, and a multitude of resources will come up also.
Okay. Now, here's a question that from the studio audience as well that may be good for Guy Gifford of DNR. It says, is the Spokane River Gorge in the city a wildland-urban interface?
Yes, that is considered the wildland urban interface. Anywhere where you have trees, wildlands intermixed with homes, it's a wildland urban interface. It doesn't have to be out in the country. A lot of the wildland urban interface nowadays are more urban-like, especially in the Spokane area. We have a lot of this natural, near-nature, near-perfect philosophy, and the Spokane City Park system is awesome, and we have a lot of those inholdings of forested land that can burn and destroy houses. We are losing homes now to these small fires from these isolated or not what we call traditional forest lands, like the Spokane River Corridor. What I'm thinking of is the Centennial Trail Corridor. Those could easily burn, run uphill, and burn homes.
This question may be related to that too, Guy, and this could be for all of us too. But how are specific decisions made to evacuate neighborhoods and communities? I'm imagining it's just when loss of life is imminent. I mean, is that
what? It really comes down to the imminent destruction of property or threat to life. Yeah. And, evacuation is one of those tenuous areas that, people sometimes refuse to evacuate. And there's nothing that you can do to make them evacuate. That's their call. What you can do is if they leave, they can't come back into the area. But evacuation is one of those things that is a hard thing for some people. I'm not leaving my home. I'm not leaving my whatever it is. And sometimes it takes a lot of discussion to get them out. But it really comes down to is life in danger at that point, and we have to get people out.
So you can't really give them a lawful order to leave their property?
No, they have that the right to defend their property if they choose to.
And I don't remember if you were here during the firestorms, but you've been here during similar incidents. Has that happened a lot, where people have said, hey, I'm staying and trying to fight my fire here at my
property?
We have
that, and we've actually, we had a fire down in Columbia County that changed a lot of state law in reference to evacuation.
Yeah.
And was centered around those events,
okay,
those type of discussions.
Now, the same person asked about the Alert Spokane system. I'm not quite sure what that is, but is that the phone alert system? What is that?
It's basically, it's not called reverse 911, but it's the easiest way to explain it. Alert Spokane is a way for 911 to reach out to the community. It's designed to reach out to small sections. Some people think that we can reach out to the entire city or the county at once. That's not true. It's about 7,000 calls an hour is about all the switch will handle. and we use it to target, you know, those specific areas that we need to get evacuated in a short amount of time. So it is not used for what you might call the emergency announcement system. EAS is a totally different system.
I wanted to talk a little bit about how the media can do a better job of getting the word out. There can be problems in coordinating efforts to get the word out via the media ourselves, and I'm thinking back as recently as just this windstorm, and Spokane Public Radio was in a unique position that exact day, and that we were partially moved out of our older facility. So we originally had a great generator set up at the other place, but we'd moved it to our new building, and it's kind of complicated. We were broadcasting out of our new facility with this generator, so when the power went down, we had a generator, but we were actually forced to go back to our old station because we had the broadcast facilities there. So we ended up in a position where we didn't have any power in the building, but we also did not have any access to our internet server, our provider. We didn't have any phone service in there, couldn't get faxes, had no way to even play back recorded, you know, materials. So I realized that may be a unique situation for us that particular time, but I can see this happening in the future where maybe a lot of the broadcast facilities that people rely on are down. If we got in a situation like that where we have personnel and maybe we can communicate with you guys, do you have any suggestions about how maybe we could do a better job getting the word out to the public about what they need to know about specifics? Because we managed to get dialed in as the days progressed. First, we got our internet service back, and that helped tremendously. But we were at an extreme disadvantage at one point where it was like working in not even radio from the 1940s, because we couldn't even record anything. So how would we in the media coordinate with you folks to get the word out? Should we just get down to having just a microphone and everything else just working with stone tools?
We actually have a entire organization when we have an emergency situation come up, and it's Joint Information Group. Those were the public information officers from whatever entities are involved in dealing with those type of events. They get together, they develop a message that needs to go out to the community, and then we contact the media and we ask them to put out specific information. So it actually works very well when we have those points of contacts. So the most important thing for the media is to make sure that we have your numbers and your point of contact. We know we have that because mm-hmm. all the PIOs have lists of media, and they actually have email groups. But that's one of the areas that we noticed in the windstorm. We are a smart generation, if you will, as far as our tools and the toys that we have, and we rely on those a lot. But when the electricity goes out, they go out. So we recommend that part of your preparedness is you have a radio that isn't necessarily dependent upon electricity. Mm-hmm. So you can hear the message once we get it out to you. So the relationship between the media and emergency management, very strong. It's just making sure that there's somebody on the other end of that message that you can hear it. And again, your computers aren't going to be working. Your cell phone may or may not, depending on how long its battery lasts, but having a good old-fashioned radio that you can get those updates is a key importance.
And I kind of just wanted to bring that up so you knew that problem existed, and maybe we can just kind of keep in touch with each other, because at some point, if this happened again, I mean, we got it dialed in when we finally had a phone service, but there was a period there where we were just literally in the dark, and I mean, we were in the dark, you know, with one light bulb in a little tiny dark room, and it was very challenging. So just the idea. Okay, here's...
Can I just add...
go ahead, Marcus.
And even when the media is up, though, I think it's important, too, giving our trusted public officials time. And so one of the things that... And I've told Sheriff Knezovich, one of the times I've been most proud of him is during Snowmageddon, we need decisive, effective, common-sense leadership, and... he said, you know what, Spokane Public Schools isn't going to operate tomorrow. And the school district said, hey, you can't make that call. And he said, I just did. And I think that's the kind of leadership we need in those times. We don't need people to go back and spend 48 or 72 hours to make a decision. If we got the right people in the room, and we got to make sure though that the microphone gets to amplify those folks that we trust in our community to make those calls.
Okay. I'm going to start pulling out a few more of these questions, so they're kind of all over the map. Now, this one is addressed to the Avista folks, and it says, are there efforts to dig power lines in low-income areas, assuming new construction is too expensive for low-income people? And I know you kind of outlined that. Can you give me just a brief response, or is that...
Well, I mean, I think I already addressed undergrounding and some of the challenges with that. I would bridge back to the storm and say that the way Avista addressed restoration, because we knew it was a multi-day event, was to identify vulnerable areas and critical facilities and infrastructure. So as the sheriff's mentioning, you know, we had cell phone towers, we had assisted living centers, we had vulnerable and distressed neighborhoods that were without power. We actually made a concerted effort, which is much different than our traditional approach, to really focus in on those. Not just with restoration of permanent power, but we were actually able, through a lot of our community organizations and partnerships, to acquire numerous generators so that we could power community centers, libraries, schools, so they could become emergency shelters. So I think it's less about trying to underground in those challenging neighborhoods. It's more important to think about what our approach would be to try to maintain reliable power for them.
Okay. And while we're on the topic of the emergency generators, I want to have Daryl Ruby again from Providence maybe identify this. Now, you're kind of the emergency manager, correct, Daryl? Of Providence Emergency.
Correct.
Yeah. Do you want to just talk a little bit about your preparedness in terms of, I mean, I know that you talked a little bit to the paper about generators and such, but you guys are actually set up to deal with lack of infrastructure type questions like this specifically, right?
Yeah, Providence Hospital, Sacred Heart in particular, is very fortunate. Our facilities folks have done a great job of planning. We actually have 9 generators just in Sacred Heart itself. And during the windstorm, we lost power right away, and so our generators kicked on, and it really allows us to run nearly the entire hospital on generator power, which is a great thing for us. I'll put in a plug for Avista, and I've shared this story numerous times. Even during the windstorm, you know, with great risk to their personnel, they were up on Cowley Avenue trying to fix that power line, because they've recognized through the public and private partnerships that you've heard people talk about here today, that restoring power to a hospital is really important. And so they were on that right away, and certainly we appreciated it, but we ran on generators for about 17 hours, which is unprecedented for us. Some of the other impacts of that, though, were the people were impacted. The hospitals are operating at near capacity, very high census, as we refer to it, every day. And so the people that came to the hospitals was above normal. We couldn't necessarily send people home because they were without power. And so it kind of has this cascading effect. We actually took a lot of people in and fed them during the shelter because people were without power. We've got a great cafeteria. And so really it just highlights, I think the message that you've heard from a lot of people here today is the importance of personal preparedness. I think organizations have a responsibility to both promote that and help their individual employees be prepared, because in the hospital setting and really every one of the organizations represented on this panel, it's vitally important that we can come into work and do the job that the public expects us to do. So we need to really focus on that personal preparedness, the organizational preparedness, community preparedness, the Map Your Neighborhood programs and things like that, and we're better able to respond.
One of the things that I'll also add to it as far as this preparedness aspect, the better prepared we are as a community, the better off we are in sustaining things as the emergency moves forward. Case in point, propane became a real issue during the windstorm. It became a real issue for your public safety because our radio towers, the ones that carry the radio waves of deputies and firefighters and everything else, some of them went down. They're backed up by generator that run on propane. Before 5 days went through, we were starting to struggle trying to find propane in this area, and we had to start looking all the way to Montana. So And the reason that was is what happens during an emergency? Everybody runs to the store and buys everything up. So all those critical assets start going dwindling very rapidly because we're not prepared. Now, if we're prepared, we can start stair-stepping that a little bit better. So again, preparedness is the key, not just for your own survival, but for the entities that are keeping everything running for you.
Yeah, and I was just thinking when you said that, because I had some damage to my home after the storm, the windstorm, and we couldn't find a building supply place that was open for a couple days because none of them had generators. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if they're thinking that in terms of that. Marcus, was there state money that was made available from the windstorm? And remind me what happened, because didn't the governor actually request federal funding for maybe not private property, but for emergency response?
So it's my recollection, and somebody can jump in, or maybe Jerry, that there was there's federal dollars coming in for the windstorm, but my grasp of that is not good.
Well,
so maybe somebody else can jump in.
I think what I might be thinking about was the fires this last summer that Governor Inslee asked for federal money, but it was turned down for private property owners. But I think that we finally got some maybe FEMA funding or something to help out the agencies that were working on it. I'm not quite sure. Ringing a bell with anybody?
I believe that's correct, but okay. Somebody else wants to jump in. I don't know.
Yeah, okay. I'm not sure. Maybe Brian can speak to that.
No, the state Mobilization Act, which is funded through the legislature, reimbursed the municipal fire departments for their activities mm-hmm. on state mobilized fires, but that's been it. We haven't received any federal monies whatsoever.
Okay. At what point do we... It's up to the governor to ask for actual federal assistance when FEMA steps in for any kind of these emergencies, correct? Or
yes.
Is that what happens?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's correct.
Declare a state emergency.
Yeah, if you'd like, I can go through it real quick.
Yeah, absolutely.
Once some thresholds have been met, and they're financial thresholds for damage, the State Emergency Management Division, which is kind of our larger agency at the state level, they run with the ball at that point, and then they push that up to the governor and ask him to request from the President of the United States a declaration of disaster. And that is what we got in this particular case, and that is why FEMA is here.
Okay. I guess we had quite a few questions in the oil train incidents, or just as we talked about before we got out here, just major train derailments with any type of chemicals like anhydrous ammonia or whatever. But in the past couple of years, more trains carrying this Bakken crude oil, as it's known, are passing through Spokane on the way to refineries on the west side. And there could be more coming through if these shipping terminals are approved. I know there's a permitting process for that going on right now for several of these. This Bakken crude oil that's coming out of North Dakota is actually much more flammable and corrosive than other types of previous oil, and the train accidents involving such material has caused some very deadly explosions. The most notable one, July of 2013, a derailment and explosion in a Quebec city killed 47 people and destroyed 30 buildings in the center of this not that big of a community. So let's talk a little bit about our preparedness for that, and we can talk to Brian and also Jerry. But so for Brian Schaefer, do we know how difficult this could be to deal with something like this? I mean, this is probably an unprecedented type of, if something like this happened in Spokane, a fire. Have you been doing some training for this kind of incident? Or
we have, Steve, for several years, ever since the product's been shipped across our rail lines that come through Spokane. We have been engaged with BNSF and UP. We're the primary companies that move product through Spokane. One of the challenges is the product itself, like you mentioned, is extremely dangerous. Spokane is in a situation where we have rail lines that are above the land. You know, they're elevated, very difficult to access, run right next to our river, go through our most populated area within the entire county. So we have a daily staffing on our hazardous materials team of 11 people. We need greater than 50 people. We have enough AFFF or aqueous film forming foam is the acronym, the type of product you would use to fight that type of a fire, we have enough for just maybe an hour if we're lucky, if we see the same type of a fire that you referred to in Canada. And we are on an island. We don't have a lot of resources. So we've been campaigning as a community to try to get the shippers to step up and assist the local agencies in not only training and something other than hoping, because hoping obviously isn't the strategy that we would really support, but preparing us, preparing us from a resource standpoint, preparing our community from kind of like what you mentioned with Alert Spokane, those devices and those tools and those plans that we have to make sure that they're adequate when they really need to be. Our Alert Spokane isn't adequate for us right now, and if we were to use it to clear out or evacuate our downtown, you're looking at 20, 30,000 people that we would have to evacuate immediately. How do we realistically notify those people? It's nice to say, well, we'll call them or go house to house, but when you look at downtown, we have vertical challenges trying to get to all those different floors, hospitals that are located directly to those railways. Mm-hmm. So it's a very complex problem that we're working with the legislature, and I know you're going to speak to that, but it's something that keeps me awake at night. It's something that I'm definitely concerned with as a chief fire officer, and it's something that I think in the green room before we came out, it was the primary topic of conversation there as well.
Well, what about, and not just the oil train explosions, but can you talk about maybe concerns with some of the other materials that are on these trains? We talked about anhydrous ammonia, but there's also, chlorine, or what else is there?
Just about everything imaginable. Everything that we use in processes across the United States to create things like the carpet that we walk on and some of the products that we use to clean are all shipped either by rail or through our interstate system. So we have to provide a response to be able to mitigate whatever happens. And you've seen some really significant events, whether it is on I-90, where we closed I-90 for almost 24 hours last summer, where we had a really dangerous chemical that they were bringing into the state of Washington that impacted commerce and put a lot of lives at risk.
In fact, that was out at the weigh station,
right,
is that what it was?
Right,
okay.
Injured some police officers, actually. We have to be able to respond to an unknown chemical, something that may be homemade. We dealt with those a lot during the meth lab era, and we're starting to see those again. And that team, our regional team, covers the majority of this part of the state. We travel throughout this area when there is an emergency dealing with hazardous materials, but we're it. And we forged a partnership now with new leadership at the Air Force Base here at Fairchild, and it's great to have that backup, but you have to realize normally when you work with a chemical, or a chemical when it's in a form that it's not used to, like during a spill or during a railway incident, if it's on fire, it doesn't behave the way it should behave. And bad things can really happen quickly. So we need more resources than what we have, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Have you been in communication with fire officials from other communities, say Seattle or some of the major other metropolitan areas, about their similar concerns, and do they feel that they're maybe in the same position you are, maybe not quite ready to deal with this? Or
I think everybody's concerned. I sat on a panel a couple months ago over on the west side with several other fire chiefs and tribes and some of the elected officials. And again, when we get into a format, when you're on the west side, there's four hazardous materials teams located on I-5 that are just less than an hour drive from each other.
Mm-hmm.
We as a community are greater than 5 or 6 hours away. When we did have the incident on I-90, I had to get on the phone. I called each one of the hazardous materials teams, including the state of Washington's Emergency Management Center, and requested help, and none of them would come because it's not covered under the State Mobilization Act. It's not a wildland fire. Nobody would come to assist us. I went all the way up to the highest levels that I could at the state EOC. I wasn't able to get suits. I wasn't able to get help. I called Idaho. I got to speak to the governor's office in Idaho, and we had Kootenai County come over and help us. That's a type of bureaucracy that we run into at 2 o'clock in the morning. But I was actually able to get a human in Idaho to help us because our people were in need. They were too worn out to continue the operation that they were doing. And we have to be able to adapt and overcome. That's what this community is about. We're extremely resilient, and we're going to get the job done regardless of what we have to do to get it done.
So those type of efforts, I mean, now that you've gone through that and you're, you know, sorting through that information later, are you now taking that as good evidence to go to the state and say, hey, we need to have more of interaction? And I'm also assuming that Marcus here is listening in and maybe can push this
been,
through too.
He's been advocating. All of our legislators have been advocating for us. But I think there's a lack of empathy between the east side and west side. The west side perception, you know, they're used to natural disasters. They have earthquakes. They have the tsunami considerations that we don't. But they have the resources that we could never compare. They're actually a UASI area, which is an acronym for Urban Special Area for the federal funding. They mm-hmm. receive dedicated funding at a huge amount because of their metropolitan statistical area. That we will never see. We hardly, and I'm sure the sheriff can speak to this better than anybody, because he's the emergency management director for the county. But when we look across eastern Washington, we get a pittance of funding compared to what the west side gets, and we have just as much, if not more, of a risk because of our situation, our staffing, and our resources.
Yeah, and as I understand it, if these other terminals were approved, and I can't remember the specific number, but there's something like 5 of these trains go through a day or something, but it would dramatically increase if these other shipping terminals got approved. So
that's the true threat that we're trying to work with these shippers. We realize the reality, or at least my perception is, the reality is we're probably not going to be able to stop these trains. If you go outside in my office and just watch the overhead tracks that go over Brown every day, we mm-hmm. see so many of them, hundreds go across through our community every day. We're probably not going to be able to stop those, but we can at least be better prepared for when the eventual disaster happens. The feds told us there are going to be crashes. I don't remember how many, but they actually told us maybe seven a year. Yeah, 7 a year. You communities across the United States, this product is going to eventually leak out and catch fire.
And I know we've had at least a couple derailments recently. There was one up in not our Riverside community up here, but Riverside in north central Washington. There was just some derailment
just a couple
this
days.
Week.
Yeah.
And then there's been a couple, I believe, up near Sandpoint, because the trains come right down through that area too.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Jerry, you seem to know a little bit more though too about, and I'll get to you, Marcus, about our state efforts on this, but so the shippers and the rail lines are actually trying to be proactive to work on modifying the rail cars. I mean, they know the specifics about this stuff is highly corrosive to the cars in a certain way, besides being more volatile and more explosive. But you're familiar with a little bit about the efforts that they're talking about trying to modify the cars? Is that what's going on?
Well, Sheriff has some input on this.
Okay.
And some other issues.
That is one of the things they're looking at is developing a better rail car for shipping this. But, you know, Steve, I'll tell you, Bakken crude is the least of my worries of what comes over those rail lines. There are things that come across those rail lines that are much worse than Bakken crude. And even if the terminals are built, there's only so much traffic that can be handled down through the Columbia River basin. They're not going to be able to increase the rail traffic so significantly because they have that choke point. There is a natural developed choke point, which is the Columbia River. As far as the rail line, they've taken some fairly extraordinary steps. One, they replaced all the track within the Spokane County main corridor.
They already have?
They have already replaced that track. They constantly monitor those tracks to make sure that they're prepared. And again, Bakken is just one aspect. Much worse things than it. They've reduced the speed of the trains. We have fire assets that we're working on. We've received grants for training for our firefighters.
Mm-hmm.
We are preparing. Every year we choose an event type. We've been working on Bakken crude for the last 2.5 years, and we're going to have a major exercise concerning Bakken crude coming up this spring and following into the fall. So these things are all things that we're looking at, we've already prepared for. The rail industry is working side by side with us in these. And the one thing that we need to remember is Spokane is kind of a railway town, if you will. We have an entire section named after Hilliard, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not, as Brian said, we're not going to just suddenly not have rail cars come through the community. Our job is to make sure that we are very prepared. I echo Brian's concerns in that there are certain assets that we just do not get because we're in Eastern Washington. We had to fight extremely hard to get the calculation of funding recalculated for Eastern Washington, and Spokane Emergency Management was key in getting that done. We receive more money now, but it's nowhere near what the West Side receives. So that's one of those disparities that seems like it, no matter what we talk about, West Side versus East Side.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're really concerned about this type of activity, Brian's team does need more equipment. They do need more manpower. And we need to be able to make sure that they have the highest quality training, not just for Bakken crude, but for everything that comes across that rail.
Yeah. Now, Marcus, can you maybe just outline briefly, I know that the legislature last session, last year, worked specifically on a couple of competing bills to deal with the concerns about these oil trains, and you want to just kind of tell us what the end result was and what had been proposed?
Well, the end result is what folks I worked for previously told me. It's legislation that gets passed has 25 senators voting for it, 50 House members, and a governor to sign it. It's not pretty. I supported Representative Jessen Farrell's bill, which did quite a bit more on this topic. In the end, the bill that we came up was not something that I was, you know, super excited about. I think it was a move in the right direction, but we needed to go much further. It requires disclosure about oil transportation, financial assurance reports, so if there is one of these accidents that the companies will step up to the plate, and contingency and prevention plans. I think we need to go much further with prevention and response procedures. And I respect Sheriff Knezovich deeply, but I do have to disagree. I think these oil bombs coming through need to be stopped, and I think we can stop them as a community. The rail companies have, you know, we're asking them to pay even their fair share, and you know, consistently haven't done it. The benefits for our community for these cars that pass through are not great, and the risks are high. So doing a simple cost-benefit analysis of the potential of a catastrophic event happening, to me, just is not worth it. So, but I will say we did pass something, and it was the result of having very divisive opinions, and in the end of the day, we came together to say we're going to take a little step forward because that's what we could get through to the governor's desk.
Okay. We're getting kind of short on time. It looks like we've got about 6 minutes. We have one audience question, and did you want to stand up here with the mic?
I have a two-part question, and they're about man-made disasters. And the first part is, how is our county and region prepared to monitor and deal with terrorist hate crimes, such as the bomb at the Martin Luther King Jr. March or the Boston Marathon bombing? And the other was something that has an economic effect on the region, is how do we deal with the takeover of public lands or government agencies such by armed groups such as happened at Malheur National Wildlife Refuge?
And good question, because I was going to talk about the threat to the Martin Luther King March. So Sheriff, we're kind of tight. Do you want to just give me I know this isn't enough time, but maybe a 1 or 2 minute overview, because I have kind of a general question for the group before we sign off here.
Very quickly. Spokane County is part of what we call the Regional Information Group 9. We're one of only four regional information groups in the state of Washington that are still remaining that do intelligence gathering and make sure that we have a pulse on those type of instances. We are advanced enough that the state of Washington looks to us for training other areas. We just trained the Richland area on intelligence gathering for those type of individuals that you just mentioned. As far as takeovers, I had communications with Sheriff Ward down in Harney County, and he had a very clear message. If things aren't done to these individuals that are doing this, there will be no safe, no small community that is safe from such action. We have had a couple of issues here locally. I'm not going to go into that. But I can tell you that my message back to the federal government was, we're not going to wait as long as they did down in Harney County, because they let things go a little bit too long. We're going to make it very clear that if you take over a government facility here in Spokane County, we'll do our best to negotiate you out, but we're not going to let you move around the county, and we're not going to let you terrorize the county.
If you guys had to just put it in a single sentence, and I know this is kind of throwing it at you, but if you can just do a real quick statement, the final question for all the panelists, what do you think would be the main priority for emergency managers and various government agencies in preparing for the most likely emergencies we face?
Well, I think personal preparedness. I think pretty much everyone here would agree that that's a huge issue. Personal preparedness at whatever level our citizens can do it, because we do realize that some are financially, socioeconomically challenged and can't do it to where we would like to have them. And so we need to really work as a community to make sure that those vulnerable populations are taken care of, as well as those that can do it well.
Very quickly, make sure that you have adequately funded your public safety. I can tell you that has not happened here at the local level, neither at the emergency management level or at your law enforcement level or even your firefighting level. We don't fund public safety the way we should.
Okay, Brian?
Ditto. And I'd just like to also mention that the importance of neighbors checking on neighbors really can't be overstated. One of the lessons learned from this last windstorm is that's really what made us successful.
Okay. Susan?
I would ditto what everyone has said, and I would say communication and seeking good, credible information when there's high fear situations involved, particularly around communicable diseases.
Okay, Megan Snow.
Yep, I would agree that personal preparedness, including one thing we haven't spoken to, is things like first aid training in your house. Have a kit, be trained, make sure that you can take care of your loved ones.
Okay, Marcus?
I think prioritize locally and then come to the funding sources and come up with a plan. One size doesn't fit all, so the communities come up with the plans, and let's figure out how we can fund those and fund planning first.
Okay. Hey, I'd like to thank all of our panelists here and all of the people that have shown up. You have been listening to our Spokane Public Radio Health and Safety Forum, hashtag prepared. I'd like to thank the panelists, specifically Representative Marcus Riccelli, Spokane County Sheriff Ozzie Knezovich, Brian Schaefer, the Assistant Fire Chief for Spokane, Susan Joburg of the Spokane Regional Health District, Jerry Bozarth, the Spokane Emergency Management, and Megan Snow of the American Red Cross. Also, the special guests that sat in, Daryl Ruby and Adam Richards of Providence Healthcare, Guy Gifford from the Department of Natural Resources, and Steve Traben of Avista Utilities, and the staff and volunteers for SPR. That includes, and I hope I got everybody's name here, Stephanie Ingleby, Kathy Sackett, Nisha Schramm, Janine Jorgensen, Martha Haynes, and Bill Wright. And I'm Steve Jackson. Thanks for joining us.
Spokane Public Radio has brought you this forum with funding from Providence, providing North Spokane with primary and urgent care, as well as complete emergency and trauma services. Details online at phc.org. By the WSU Elson S. Floyd College of Medicine, working toward accreditation for Washington's newest medical school at medicine.wsu.edu. Also, Numeric Credit Union, prepared to serve the community in ordinary and extraordinary times. Life moves, live well. More at numericacu.com. And the Journal of Business, the Inland Northwest source for local business news, celebrating 30 years of serving the local business community in print, online, and on the go, spokanejournal.com.